Jodi Arias, the only murderer in modern history that has her meat curtains draped all over the internet. Jodi is the epitome of a psycho ex-girlfriend. She and Travis Alexander fall in lust. They're ripped apart by her jealousy and his religion. Basically, if she can't be with Travis, no one's gonna. Get this crazy bitch a rubber room and a straitjacket, bro. Maybe take some notes, guys. What's up, guys? It's your girl Ginger, the true crime queen. I'm reminding you now that listener discretion is advised. The dark nature of this show is not suitable for little ears or those that are sensitive to graphic material. But without further ado, let's get it. Hi, patrons and future patrons. I wanted to do a Patreon preview for a little taste of the Patreon content. That's where I really like to cover the big, big cases like this one. If you're not familiar with the names, then I got a hell of a story for you today. 30-year-old Travis Alexander was viciously murdered in his own home by his on and off again girlfriend, 27-year-old Jodi Arias, in the summer of 2008. Today in part one, we'll learn all about the background of Jodi and Travis and their relationship, what went wrong, the creepy-ass depths she went to cover her tracks to commit this quote-unquote perfect murder, and of course, the brutal act itself. In part two, we'll continue on with all of Jodi's dumbass mountain of lies, leading to quite literally the most sexually graphic trial I have ever heard. But it would actually end up taking a total of three trials to put her away for good, so go on, grab some snacks, some popcorn, because this shit is like Fatal Attraction 2.0, you guys. Heads up, the episode is considerably more sexual than the rest of my episodes, so heads up for that if you have any prudes or littles around that, you know, might hear a couple new words today if you don't keep this on the DL. Also, she went pretty ham on this poor guy during the murder, so I'll definitely have to go through some cringy moments, but I'll warn you when we get there. So we'll start with Jodi. I'm surprised a Snapped episode hasn't covered her case specifically yet, but Jodi Ann Arias was born on July 9th of 1980 in Yreka, California, which is just across the border to Oregon. Her family would eventually move down to the Santa Maria area of California, and I believe that Jodi is actually the oldest of four children, with one younger sister and two younger brothers. Jodi's parents were said to have owned a little family restaurant, and I think they would have probably been considered a pretty nice lower middle class family for their particular area of California. Physically, if you've never seen a picture of Jodi Arias, she's actually very pretty, but I've learned that she's also the type that knows it too. Either way though, she's seemingly intelligent. I read that she liked to draw, and I've seen that she's not a terrible singer. From what I can honestly tell, Jodi pretty much grew up normally, and there isn't much that I found to indicate that she would turn out to be such a big cunt. I really don't think she was into bad drugs or anything like that, except for one time in 8th grade, apparently her mom would find some weed plants that Jodi was growing, and her parents decided to call the fucking cops. You know what? If my kids try that shit, I'm not gonna call the cops, I'm just gonna smoke their entire fucking crop. I mean, can you imagine the feeling as a 13-year-old whose parents said they just called the cops on you? I would be scared to death. I sort of believe, too, this might have actually started some sort of need for Jodi to feel as though that she has to hide things from her parents now. Her parents have went on to say in interviews that ever since that incident, Jodi was always nervous that they were snooping through her stuff, and she wouldn't tell them anything about, like, her boyfriends, and she became, like, super aggressive with her privacy, according to her dad. Whenever they wanted to come and visit her, she wouldn't allow them to stay at her place because she was too paranoid or basically too afraid that they were gonna snoop through her stuff. See? I mean, like, she's got some trust issues already, it sounds like to me. And in interviews before the trial with Jodi, she very clearly announced that she was never abused. She even said herself during this jailhouse interview before the trial that, sometimes my family jokes that my mom didn't beat me hard enough. Oh my god, you don't say. But then later, during her sentencing phase, she would actually end up telling the jury how her parents were super abusive, how they would shove or smack her and all her siblings in anger. And she sort of like shit all over them, honestly, after saying all these great things about them prior to the trial. She had this story that her mom would use, you know, the trusty wooden spoon to assert her authority. But seriously, though, are you even a teenage girl if your mom doesn't have that go-to weapon, whether it's the spoon or the sandal? I mean, for real, though. Obviously, it's not okay to beat your kids, but if you grew up with one of these moms like I did, you know the spoon is more of a deterrent than an actual weapon. But just so we're clear, I wouldn't trust Jody as far as I could personally throw her. So honestly, I think all the abuse stuff was bullshit after watching her on the stand for literally hours and hours. As a teenager, Jody's first major relationship was apparently with a dude named Bobby who was working as a cashier. And he was a tad older from what I can tell. He's the stereotypical grungy, angsty 18-year-old. Naturally, because it's young love, you know, they were on and off. But eventually, Jody decides, you know what? Fuck this shit, I'm moving out at age 17. So she moves out of her parents' home and moves straight over to her boyfriend Bobby's. And surprise, surprise, she ends up dropping out of high school shortly after. But you know what? She scores a dope-ass job at the local Denny's as a waitress. Them's are money moves, you guys, am I right? Here's a life tip. Do not drop out of high school just to wait tables at Denny's. You do that shit when you're stacking college credits, okay? Anyways, another big surprise, Jody will eventually find out that her dream boyfriend Bobby has lost his job and he's sitting at home all day chatting up other girls on MySpace. Yes, MySpace. So obviously Jody freaks out and they get into this huge fight. And I mean, I guess this was like a super physical ass fight when thankfully, I guess they finally break up for good. I think at this point he decides to move out and that's when she decides to start dating the roommate Matt. Classy. Now, this guy has managed to keep the relationship that he had with Jody pretty much off the internet. So the only place that I found the little information on this Matt guy that I did was from Jody's own testimony. So take it all with a grain of salt, really. And I do swear this is all relevant to the whole story, especially this second Matt guy, because he actually comes back into the picture later down the timeline, too. So when her and Matt started dating in the year 2000, she was 20, and Matt and her were already friendly because of this living situation. And Matt was also aware of how shady Bobby was behind Jody's back. So when they started dating, he was said to have been a lot more respectful, and he never laid a hand on her. Matt also seems to have his shit together quite a bit more. He was a manager at a nearby Subway, and by that time, Jody's working at Applebee's. She said their biggest problem was really that he just wouldn't pick up after himself, which, I don't know, that just seems to be like an every person thing. But almost 2 years into their relationship, Jody was actually confronted by some of Matt's coworkers who ended up ratting him out for flirting with some other girl at his work. So yet another guy is actually taking Jody for granted, I guess. She actually found out where this other girl lived, and she went and knocked on her door and got it straight from the other girl. She explained on the stand that with this girl, it wasn't really a fight and that Matt had told her that he was single. So Jody goes back home and she ends up breaking things off when she confronts him with all the shit she just found out. So Jody actually ends up moving away and she moves down to a resort area with a new job at some event center type place. Matt does shortly follow her down later and he begins working at the same resort, but at this point they're just friends, I guess. So now it's 2002, and a 22-year-old Jody is working at this event place called the Ventana Inn and Spa, where she would end up meeting her next boyfriend, Daryl. He's 20 years her senior, and he also happens to be coming out of his own pretty nasty divorce, but also, he's her manager. And they will swear up and down that they didn't actually begin dating until after he switches jobs. Who cares? But Jody and this Daryl dude would eventually end up buying a house together for some reason. She ends up picking up a second job at the California Pizza Kitchen, and Daryl even scored Jody some bigger tits. He even testified in court that he only paid $300 for them from some place in La Jolla. And I damn near choked on my coffee when I heard that because he had to have meant $3,000. Because that's by far the cheapest boob job I've ever heard of. There's no fucking way it was a $300 boob job. Uh-uh. Anyways, while Jody's working at California Pizza Kitchen with her new tits, she learns about this thing called prepaid legal service, which from what I can tell is one of those refer a member, get a bonus downline type of things. It's basically a pyramid scheme, but you know, she's really interested in making it a little bit more Skrilla now. So she signs up, she starts learning how to sell legal insurance apparently. And by 2006, Jody is getting the opportunity to travel a little bit more now. She's meeting some new friends through this PPL business. And while she's in Las Vegas for one of their big annual conventions, she's standing outside the Rainforest Cafe and she happens to walk by a guy named Travis Alexander. And he's hanging with some of his team members on PPL and they end up getting introduced to each other. Jody and Travis get to talking, and he actually ends up inviting her to be his plus one to this, like, big fancy-ass dinner that's only for the bigwigs in the company, which she learns that Travis sort of is. Interestingly, there's actually a picture of when they're at dinner together just after they had met for the first time, which, of course, I'll include in the episode photos per the usual, but Jody and Travis actually ended up spending the entire rest of this multi-day trip together and ending it with exchanging numbers because Travis actually lives in Mesa, Arizona, and Jody lives in Redding, California, with Sugar Daddy Daryl. Jody said in interviews that she really did not expect Travis to call her, but he actually happened to call the very next day. And so soon they're beginning to make plans to meet up for weekend getaways. A week after they meet, they hang out again, and he introduces her to the Book of Mormon and even invites her to attend church with him. They would start spending a lot of time talking about the religion over the next few weeks as her and Daryl are slowly but surely growing apart. I mean, it's pretty freaking clear to me that she was way over Daryl at this point. Because she, no shit, came back home and told this guy Daryl, hey, he can't cuss around her anymore. But also announced that she is now saving herself strictly for marriage. So they aren't going to be having any more sex unless he wants to put a ring on it, which she knows he doesn't want to because he legit just got divorced. Can you imagine your young, hot girlfriend coming home with her $300 fake-ass titties that you just bought and her being like, you know what, cursing is second to the devil and sex is just no longer an option for us. But thanks for the tits though, okay, bye. Luckily, this guy Daryl actually manages to get away from Jody when he chooses to move out of their home because his ex-wife is actually moving further south and he cared more about being close to his son than he cared about being a square bear with Jody. And he was even nice enough to continue paying his half of the mortgage for a while, then even her half when she wasn't making enough money at the prepaid legal biz because she was a tad bit more worried about bagging Travis's balls than selling legal insurance. So I should probably give a little background on Travis now. He is the victim in our story. Travis was born on July 28th of 1977, and he actually grew up in a significantly worse situation than Jody was raised in. His parents were said to be pretty abusive drug addicts who would literally leave him and his several younger siblings at home without food. I believe there was four brothers and four girls in his family. But thanks sweet baby Jesus, because Travis's little Mormon grandma would actually come through and end up taking him and all his siblings into her home. Travis was eventually baptized at the age of 10, and it would quite literally change like his entire path in life. He ends up being a very hard worker. He seems pretty polite overall, and he even ended up doing the whole mission thing at age 18 where, you know, you knock on doors for 2 years, spreading the word of your Lord and Savior. But after this mission is when he becomes involved in prepaid legal services, the same thing Jody's in. And Travis would sort of become this motivational speaker there and somewhat of a highly respected person within the company. And he was good at it, especially after spending the last 2 years going door to door telling people about his faith. He's just really good at talking to people. But basically, when Jody meets Travis, he's a fucking stud. He's got his nice big bachelor pad with a couple roommates. He's rising up the ladders at work. He's spending time with friends, traveling to different places, and looking like the ultimate catch in Jody, and I think a lot of other girls' eyes, honestly. So Jody and Travis have this long distance thing kind of going on. They're like hella flirting and making out, but no actual sex, of course, because Mormons have this law of chastity, which means that they're not having any sexual relations prior to marriage. And now that Daryl is out of the picture, but he's still paying all her bills, Jody and Travis are getting together almost every single weekend and things are heating up. They're honestly sort of like horny teenagers at this point. They have to sneak around the house at like overnight functions with their church friends because they can't get caught doing, you know, sinful shit, of course. But I think it's just part of, like, the whole attraction for them here, honestly. After 2 months of hanging around the Mormon community like this, Jody decides that she's actually going to hop right into it and she's going to commit. Travis is actually the one that got to baptize a very excited Jody on November 26th of 2006. And she did the damn thing. She changed into the typical dressing. She walked into the pool thing. Travis blessed her. He dipped her. And she said she felt peaceful after. And it was exactly where she was supposed to be. She's a woman of God now. And how else does one celebrate getting baptized? Well, I bet you didn't think I was going to say butt sex, did you? Nope. So much for that law of chastity, huh? Well, I guess some Mormons, and I'm thinking mainly just young male Mormons, will reason that there is this sort of loophole, a poop hole loophole, as they call it, actually. And the reasoning is that butt sex doesn't actually count as real sex, and technically everyone's still virgins. So we're talking middle school myths here now. And the only reason I'm actually having to tell you this is because Jody would actually spend 18 days straight on the witness stand telling these horribly cringy and graphic recounts of all the times she and Travis ever hooked up, making this defense case that Travis was nothing but a proper Mormon on the streets, but a damn freak in the sheets. So for 18 days straight, Travis's family and hers would actually have to sit here in a courtroom with the public and listen to all this very private shit come straight out of the killer's own poop hole. Mouth. Her defense would try everything to destroy Travis's reputation. And these sexual revelations were really just the tip of the iceberg, ladies and gentlemen. Anyways, even after Travis baptizes Jody, they're friendly and they're, you know, fooling around. But they're actually continuing to go on regular type dates with other people at times. Yet Travis and Jody are most definitely fooling around on the DL. By February of 2007, though, about 3 months after Travis baptizes Jody, they finally feel comfortable enough to announce that they're boyfriend and girlfriend, at least to his friends. Jody would seem pretty invested in this relationship. She's converted to the religion. She's now thinking of moving to Mesa to be closer to Travis. But then his own friends would sort of indicate that whenever Jody's hanging around, she's like super into PDA, which Travis is not that type, and that she would wait outside his bathroom door. Like, she would never mingle with the other girls. And basically, we got ourselves a fucking stage 5 clinger, people. So Travis's friends eventually indicate to him that she really doesn't seem like, you know, the best girl for him long term. One of them was even joking that she was afraid that they were going to find Travis's body cut into a million pieces one day. JK, LOL. But that's when they noticed that Jody was actually listening around the corner to that entire whole conversation. And that same girl and her husband, the friend of Travis's, they came on the Nancy Grace show. And when they said that they caught Jody listening, that the look on her face was fucking psycho shit. And that literally the same night, they told Travis that Jody was no longer welcome in their home. Awkward. So the situation, I think, is creating this weird divide where Travis wants to hang out with his friends, but they don't really want to hang out with Jody anymore. So he sort of has to back off and separate the two. And within a couple weeks of that, Jody is starting to snoop through Travis's email accounts and his phone. And what does she find? Travis has been flirting up some other girls. Oh, fuck. Oh, shit. Oh, no. Well, they end up breaking up. Duh. But it would seem pretty freaking casual from the way that Jody tells it. Then again, she is the only one around to say how it really went. But shortly after this breakup in the summer of 2007, Jody would pick up all her shit and move all the way from California to Mesa. And for what reason? Who the fuck really knows? I'm thinking it's literally because she's trying to keep tabs on Travis, honestly. From what I can gather, she was trying as hard as she could, at the very least, continue being friends with Travis, possibly trying again in the future to be more than friends. Well, Travis ends up taking this breakup with Jody pretty seriously, and he starts dating a new girl named Lisa, who is also a nice Mormon girl in their circle of friends. Well, Jody only lives 5 minutes away now, so she's literally popping into Travis's place randomly. She's always driving by to see what he's up to. And one evening, Jody gets real fucking triggered when she starts spying on Travis through his backyard window and finds him and his new girlfriend, Lisa, making out on the couch. And now she's fucking pissed. It was really funny when she was on the stand, though, talking about this, too, because the prosecutor, Juan Martinez, made this huge issue out of how creepy she was for spying on Travis like this. Like, this prosecutor really hates Jody from these court videos that I watched. His cross-examination was the highlight of most of the testimony. And by the way, this whole entire 60-plus day trial is available on YouTube, so. So what does Jody do when she finds out that Travis is dating this new girl? Well, Jody goes apeshit and she slashes Travis's tires. And not once. She ended up doing it twice. And she would eventually slash the new girlfriend Lisa's tires too. Fucking psycho. And I'm pretty sure Jody acted like it wasn't her for a while. But during the trial, I actually found that she had this sort of repayment arrangement with Travis to pay him back for all these damages. So he must have known it was her slashing his tires and eventually confronted her at some point. But regardless of all this damage she's causing, they would still continue to have this secret late-night relationship when he isn't with other girls. One time, while he's out of town on business, he had another friend of his check on his dog, and when they did, they actually found Jody in his kitchen making cookies, unbeknownst to Travis. And even though they aren't dating anymore, people are aware that she's causing him problems, so Jody's still creeping into Travis's home through his doggy door to get on his computer, snoop through his things, which would obviously make someone mad, but then she would sort of work it all out with these sexual favors as sort of a friends with benefits thing, thinking it's like this cute little game that they're playing. I mean, it's some shit, honestly. At this point, you can tell Jody has some serious mental issues at the very least, but also has this majorly toxic interest in Travis. I mean, they have it for each other, truly, but he's continuing to use her at the same time purely for sex since he's not really getting anywhere with any of these other Mormon chicks. So Jody obviously knew this too, and she's going to use it to get herself out of trouble when it came to these annoying little things that she would be doing to Travis. Jody even started sending threatening emails over to Lisa, hoping to push her out of the picture, I'm guessing. Eventually, Lisa is like, sorry, Travis, I'm, you know, not one of those Mormons who believe in the loophole, and your ex is very much scaring me, so bye-bye. And they basically break it off. So then Travis meets this other girl named Mimi, and his friends are like really banking on this girl being the one to pull Travis totally away from Jody. She's much better for him all around, and I guess he might have seen her that way too. And even Jody would end up meeting someone new while at one of these big PPL events. This new guy's name is Ryan, and he lives up in Utah. But like Jody and Travis, he's in town for this work event, and Ryan and Jody ended up exchanging numbers. So Travis was also at that event, and maybe he saw Jody with Ryan. And possibly it prompted this very upbeat and positive post to his MySpace page about how excited he was for the next chapter in his life. And this would be in the middle of April 2008, but he goes, "This year will be the best year of my life. This is the year that will eclipse all others. I will earn more, learn more, travel more, serve more, love more, give more, and be more than all the other years combined." And it goes on a little more, but that's what I'm going to do. To his friends, it kind of seems like Jody is out of the picture at this point. But to be totally honest, her and Travis are still talking, but not for much longer. Travis wakes up one day at the end of April to find Jody, once again, inside his house, this time vacuuming his living room super early in the morning. And he, like, totally loses his shit. She's gone too far. This shit isn't funny anymore. Jody, it's not fucking cute. Just stop. So clearly, Travis is very done with her bullshit, because he then volunteers to help pay for Jody to move her broke ass back to her grandparents in California, because apparently her living situation in Mesa had come to an end. And he was not about to let her move into his place. So they move her back to California, and Travis is stoked that she's finally going to be getting out of his fucking life. She's 300 miles away now. Travis's friends will actually talk about how Travis seemed like he had completely moved on from Jody and that he was, you know, getting to know Mimi better. And they really felt like she might be wifey material. During that same month, Travis actually requested that the ticket holder of an upcoming work trip to Cancun, Mexico, actually be changed from Jody to this Mimi. And apparently he had earned this trip through work, and Jody was probably hoping to remain on that trip to some degree. So most people are aware that Jody and Travis are no longer a thing. He's seeing this Mimi girl, but there were a few select people that were still aware that Travis was having problems with Jody on some level. And apparently of those few friends of his that did know Jody was slashing his tires and sneaking into his house still, they still didn't see her as a real threat. Like, yeah, she's sort of clingy and obviously super annoying, but hey, she's also sort of hot and she's apparently cool with the loophole and she's like 110 pounds. So what the fuck is she gonna do, Travis? Shoot him? That's crazy talk. It would actually seem, though, like Jody was also moving on too, because even though her and Travis would occasionally talk, she was also talking to this new guy Ryan from Utah pretty regularly, through email and also on the phone. But next, on May 10th of 2008, something really interesting happened. I'm not sure who called who originally, but Travis and Jody were talking on the phone, like they're reliving old times, they're talking about their previous sexcapades. They're flirting a little, and it actually leads to them having this full-blown phone sex for over an hour. And you know how we know this? She fucking recorded it, without his knowledge. Why though? I mean, I'm not exactly sure if there's just one single reason here, but it's pretty freaking obvious that Jody is starting a plan to blackmail Travis by recording one or maybe even a couple of these occasional late-night phone sex calls that they would have. Maybe because she wants to ruin his upcoming Cancun trip with this new girlfriend, possibly, I don't know. And since Travis is a highly respected member of his Mormon no-sex-having church, and also quite a big name in PPL, if everyone knew how freaky-deaky he really was, it would not only ruin his reputation as a devout Mormon, but also probably cost him his job. And of course, we're looking, you know, after the fact too, so hindsight's 20/20. Unless you guys can come up with any other reasons why Jody might be recording her and Travis's phone sex calls a month before she ends up murdering him, you know, I'm all ears. And they played this whole damn phone recording in court. Every fake orgasm, all of Travis's dirty interests, I mean, all of it. There were things in this conversation that have ruined certain foods for me. Never again will I eat a Tootsie Roll without thinking of Jody Arias. It's fucking wild, you guys. It's online if you want the nasty details, but I can't even. Anyways, the next big thing we know for sure is that on May 26th, a couple weeks after this recorded phone call, Travis and Jody somehow get into this big fight. I think because she had once again hacked into his social media and probably confronted him about the fact that he was taking this other girl to Mexico with him. Maybe she even possibly threatened him with these recorded phone sex calls. He seemed really mad. We know all of this because detectives have recovered the emails and these message threads that very clearly show that Travis was so mad at Jody about something. He basically called her every name in the good Lord's book. I mean, he indicated she was evil. He said that he was nothing but a dildo with a heartbeat to her and that she was just a three-hole wonder to him. And basically to stay out of his life forever. And as creative as three-hole wonder is, I think when he ended up calling her a sociopath and told her to stay out of his life for good, basically, you know, kick rocks, Jody, I think the flip switched in her. I think the last thing you want to tell an actual fucking sociopath is the ugly truth, and it legit triggered her. So she's now lost Travis. He hates her. I mean, he told her that she was the worst thing that had ever happened to him, and that from the looks of these emails, she went just way too far. And now she's lost control of the entire situation. And even more interestingly, 2 days after that big fight, on May 28th, Jody's grandparents' home, the place that she's also living, had a reported burglary. Her grandparents had come home in the afternoon to find their home's back door kicked in with just a couple things that were taken from the home. It was a stereo set with some speakers, a portable DVD player, some like $30 in cash, and a 25 caliber pistol that had 7 bullets in it. It was apparently a pretty old gun that had been passed down through the family a couple times, so the serial number was definitely unknown by Jody's grandfather, who technically owned this gun. What's interesting about this burglary, though, is that the cabinet that this little 25 caliber was taken from also had a bunch of other guns in it, mostly rifles, but you know what? The burglar just didn't want any of those ones, huh? So now the last couple days in May of 2008 are definitely premeditated. Jody makes a few calls to some friends of hers. She hit up, no joke, 6 different dudes and 1 girl, including a couple of her exes that are living throughout Southern California. And she casually mentions that she will be in town for one of her, you know, typical random-ass road trips if they wanted to hang out. She also hits up the new guy Ryan in Utah and said the same shit, asking if she could crash there. To which he is like, fuck yeah, Jody, you can come hang out in my parents' basement with me, sure. So on the early morning of Monday, June 2nd, Jody and Travis are actually calling each other back and forth. It seems as though Jody called Travis 4 times between 1 and 3 a.m. All four went unanswered, but Travis actually called Jody back after the 3 o'clock hour, and they end up having 2 phone calls, one for 18 minutes and another for 42 minutes. Jody then calls Travis back one last time for a quick 2 to 3 minute phone call at 4:03 a.m. I'm thinking she kept it pretty casual, you know, based on what we think the last conversation was. And she just mentions that she's going on one of these random road trips to Utah and that she could always just drop by probably for a little quickie if he's, you know, down. Which, because he's not getting it anywhere else in this very modest community, I am pretty sure he was like, okay, yeah, come through. So when Jody's on the stand, she made it kind of seem like she was only going on this trip to see the new guy Ryan in Utah, and that Travis basically guilted her into stopping by for his final booty call before he left for Mexico. And, you know, he's just so persuasive that she just had to oblige. Like, oh my god, don't make me fucking gag, bitch. I see right through your bullshit. After those early morning phone calls with Travis, Jody then starts her road trip, and she drives her own car down to Redding, California. It's about an hour and a half south from where she's living, and she parks it at her brother's home. She is taken to get her pre-ordered rental car at the Redding, California Municipal Airport, the Budget Enterprise place. She said that she rented this car for the road trip because her car wasn't the best with gas, and this would save her a lot of money. And also, she would just be using it locally, so no mention of a road trip to the employee. Okay then, but listen to this shit. While renting this car, actually, she finishes all the paperwork, she signs it, she walks outside, and she sees the car that they picked out for her to drive when she notices the car they chose for her was red. The color red. She actually turned around, went back inside, and legit asked them if they would change the car for her. And you guys, on the witness stand, she explains that she had always heard growing up that you just shouldn't drive a red car because you're more likely to be pulled over by a cop. Which, yeah, obviously most people don't want that to happen to them unnecessarily. But especially not if you're trying to be all fucking cognito on a murder trip to kill your ex-boyfriend. I cannot believe she actually said that in court. I've always heard that you never want to drive a red car because the car insurance companies charge you more. But maybe I got the tip wrong. I mean, I'm not the murderer. So also, her own defense lawyer brought this whole conversation up, and he suggested the possibility that she might have instead claimed that the red car that they had given her smelled of cigarette smoke or something like that. And that's the reason why she requested a different car. But nope, she goes, no, I specifically said I didn't want a red car because they are known to be pulled over more by the police. That is the only reason. So she, like, literally gives her own defense no fucking help, and she is not picking up on their clues at all. It's so funny to watch. Anyways, after she makes this very odd request of changing the car because of the color, even the guy working there said in court that this was one of the most odd requests he'd ever had for switching cars, they offer her a very bland, very shitty, at least from my experience with them, a white Ford Focus. So after getting this white car, she drives it back to her brother's house in Redding, California, and crashes there for a little power nap before she starts her quote-unquote road trip. Which is really nothing more than meeting up with 6 different dudes and maybe a girl, and that's why I like to call her Hody. So after her little power nap, she says in court that she hopped on the I-5, she headed south a little before noon, and had planned on meeting this old guy named Gus that also works for PPL for some reason. But you know, she just couldn't fit it into the schedule, so she actually ends up pulling over somewhere near Sacramento and takes another power nap. She says she finally ends up arriving in the Santa Cruz area of California around 9 p.m., and that she meets up with her ex-boyfriend Matt and his friend at some bar called the Red Room for some appetizers. They later ended up at a nearby karaoke bar before heading back to Matt's parents' place to sleep for the rest of that Monday night. And you know what song I bet Jody Arias was singing for karaoke that night? Because I'm getting some One Way or Another Blondie vibes. I don't know. What do you guys? So next, on the early morning of Tuesday, June 3rd, Jody proceeds to drive south to her other ex-boyfriend Daryl's place in Pacific Grove, where they have breakfast omelets together, and she ends up requesting to borrow 2 gas cans from him. She reasoned because gas is much cheaper in Nevada and Utah compared to like gas prices in California, she wanted to stock up on gas and save money. Cause you know, she's this broke ass bitch on a budget, which really would add an ever more frustrating component to planning the perfect murder. I mean, being broke as fuck, and she probably was broke as fuck, but that's not why she asked for these cans, you guys. Too bad for Jody too, because this ex Daryl did actually testify in court, and under the intense ass scrutiny of the case prosecutor, Juan Martinez, Daryl had to very hesitantly admit that he did in fact loan Jody 2 5-gallon gas cans for some road trip to Mesa. And this exact moment was like the state's best example of clear premeditation that Jody did not want to be seen in Arizona during this so-called road trip. So she stocked up on gas so she wouldn't have to stop and buy any while she was in Arizona, and it could appear as though she was never there and therefore could not have killed Travis. Her ex quite literally was like, yes, when asked if he'd loan her these gas cans. And the look on Jody's face was like, fucking shit, Daryl. It was good. Jody claims that after leaving Daryl's, she next had plans to drive more south to stop in and see his sister's newborn baby so that Jody could take some photos for her photography portfolio. Unfortunately, his sister never got back to Jody after meeting up, and it fell through. Which, yeah, there's no fucking way I would let this stage 5 clinger near my newborn either. Receipts that Jody kept, though, very clearly outline almost every one of the moves that Jody made throughout this entire trip. After getting the 2 gas cans from Daryl, she heads over to Salinas to get her nails did, because, you know, she's going to see Ryan, whom was the alleged main purpose for the whole trip. But she then went and purchased a 3rd gas can at a Pasadena Walmart at 3:22 in the afternoon. She later makes another purchase at CVS around 8:31, and it just says healthcare on the receipt, but I'm kind of guessing that that's hair dye that Jody bought to remain as low profile as possible from anyone that might see her at Travis's. She had previously been a blonde, but most definitely dyed her hair brunette while on this trip. The guy she rented the car from even said she was blonde. Next, she stops at a Starbucks. She gets a strawberry frappuccino and an egg salad sandwich. Those sound really gross together, to be honest. And she mentions on the stand that she noticed, you know, some no-good skater kids out by her car when she was exiting the Starbucks. But, you know, no big deal, right? Just some weird-ass detail. She then goes over to an Arco gas station there in Pasadena. She fills up her rental car on her MasterCard, and then also fills up her 3 gas cans with cash in a separate transaction. Weird. Not only did she pay in cash, but also she's filling up these gas tanks while in California, where she had claimed earlier her whole reason for borrowing these gas cans wasn't to hide the fact that she was driving through Arizona. It was because she was going to be stocking up on gas in Nevada and Utah. Okay. So why the fuck did she end up filling them all up in California? I don't get it. That doesn't make... Come on, Jody. Because she's so full of shit at this point, she's losing track of her own lies. For real. And just before Jody crosses over into the state of Arizona from California, she strategically makes a call to Ryan up in Utah at about 9 p.m. and she says that she's officially on her way there and that her phone's almost dead. She'll likely be there in the early morning the next day. That would be Wednesday, June 4th. Her and Ryan even made some plans to attend this PPL training event together that was scheduled at like noon or 1 or something that Wednesday. So before shutting her phone down, though, she also makes one last phone call to Travis. And it was probably something like, yo, I'll be there in 6 hours or so. So she then pulls over somewhere to, no fucking lie, remove the license plate from the rental car before eventually arriving at Travis's home in Mesa, Arizona. Now, remember this license plate thing, because we will talk about it later down the road, too. It's a ballsy fucking move, honestly. So Jody powers down the phone and she's off into the night. And I envision her just fucking slumping the whole way to Travis's house with like, murder was the case that they gave me. Jody shows up at Travis's home in Mesa around 4:30 a.m. on the early morning of June 4th, 2008. Jody will explain on the stand that this is because Travis was aware Jody was on a road trip to Utah for an event, not to shack up with Ryan. When Travis had guilted Jody to the pants party at his place in Mesa, to which she graciously accepted. So Jody pulled up to Travis's home in her white, licenseless, P piece of shit Ford Focus and her freshly dyed brunette hair. She claims she entered the backyard and allowed herself through the garage door because this was just her usual way of like coming into the home, apparently. Which honestly sounds like a lot more fucking effort than just walking through the front door like a normal person. Whatever, Jody. On a side note, though, I learned between Jody and Travis's friends' interviews that Travis's garage code number was actually 0187, which, if you didn't know, was actually the California State Penal Code for murder. And that's why Snoop Dogg's always saying 187 and shit back in the 90s. And every time that number comes up, sort of for like a lack of a better word, innocently in a true crime case like this, I mean, I almost sort of see it as this omen. Now, I'm also researching another case, actually, that also has the number 187 in one of its crucial small details, and it just always gives me the creeps now when I see it. Watch how often it will show up now in your true crime stuff that I pointed out to you if you weren't already privy on the 187 standing for murder. Anyways, Jody enters Travis's home, and she then explains that she found Travis in his office watching some random YouTube videos with his little pug, Napoleon. She admitted on the stand to just standing there yet again and watching him silently for like a good 30 seconds or so because she thought he was just so cute. And thank God again for Juan Martinez, the prosecutor, pointing out just how fucking creepy and weird that is because he's honestly just saying what is on everybody else's mind. She tells the court that she was tired from driving all day and that he stayed up late waiting for her. So by this time it's like 5 a.m. and they're both tired and they just go to bed and apparently sleep until about noonish. Now, the next thing we know for sure is that Jody and Travis wake up, and her and Travis will end up having this sort of naughty-ass X-rated photo session. And we know this because the photos have been recovered, and every single one of them is timestamped, proving Jody was, in fact, inside Travis's home that day, and these timestamped nudes were shown to the entire courtroom on a huge projector for everyone, I mean everyone, to see. There's basically a few nudes of each of them, sort of just, you know, posing naked, just like most youngins in their 20s stupidly do. And honestly, this is all just a perfect example of why that's such a bad idea, you guys. Remember this when you want to take these photos with someone that you aren't married to, because life tips here, just looking out for you guys. Literally everyone and their mom can now look up Jody Arias's meat flaps any freaking time they want. And do you want that for yourself? No, you don't. I really doubt Travis ever did either, and I doubt he ever thought that these photos would actually end up as public as they are, but I honestly think that Jody did somewhat know the possibility of these becoming public. Considering the order of events here, she knew what she was doing when these photos were being taken. So after these risque photos are taken, Jody then says her and Travis had sex a few times. She claims they tried tying her up to his bed, but it wasn't working out very well, so they just made a couple short videos or two. They watch them, they delete them, and then she claims that she takes a shower in his master bathroom while Travis goes downstairs and checks his email. And then it would be his turn to take a shower. We would later find out that he actually had a super important conference call for work later that day that he would end up missing. So at this point, Jody is dressed and she grabs the camera again and starts taking this second set of photos. They are of just of Travis while he is within the stand-up shower stall in the master bathroom at about 5:22 p.m. and the shower door is open. The series of photos continues with a photo like every 30 seconds to a minute and a half. And they're really just Jody's super sad attempt at being artistic, I guess, with this like water backdrop aesthetic thing. And honestly, it's not good at all. And they seem very awkward and super unprofessional, but the second to the last photo taken shows Travis looking straight into the camera, which is unlike all of the other photos, which are mainly just body shots of him not looking at the camera. And then all of a sudden there's this look on Travis's face just does not seem very pleased, really. I'll add it into the photos too, but to me his eyes almost say, fuck, in this sort of way. The very last photo was then taken at 5:32 p.m. and it would actually show Travis sitting down, naked, in the bottom of his shower. And his right side is facing the shower door where Jody is taking the pictures. And it almost seems as though this photo was taken maybe accidentally on a timer or something because the angle doesn't make much sense at all. But you can definitely tell that Travis is now sitting in his shower, which has got to be certainly awkward because he's a pretty big, I mean, like, tall man, honestly. So his legs are sort of like hunched over, and it's even possible that she might have instructed him to sit down, because I can't understand any other reason he would just sit down in a shower like this. It's awkward. So trigger for cringe, because it's about to get into some serious overkill, you guys. The order of the events that happens in the next 136 seconds, based on the photos, is highly debated because the only one to say what happened is a total fucking pathological liar. What physically transpired to Travis's body includes 27 to 29 stab wounds to the body, including his chest, back, hands, feet, and head. Travis's throat was then deeply slashed from ear to ear, and he had even been shot in his fucking head. Like, that's pretty extra as fuck if you ask me, or like anyone else on the planet, right? Any one of those three things would have likely caused the death, but no, he had to suffer for some reason all three. Now, without even knowing any of this crazy ass background story, wouldn't you, at first glance, consider 27 fucking stab wounds already somewhat of a rage-induced killing? I mean, I know you and I aren't FBI profilers, but goddamn, you and I both know that it seems quite obvious that whoever killed Travis, at least, really, really, really wanted him dead. Know what I'm saying? The order in which these wounds would have had to occur to Travis are still a really big argument within the true crime community, mainly because the amount of decomposition to Travis's body by the time it was found leaves a lot of unknowns. The prosecution's theory is actually that Jody stabbed him, slit his throat, then shot him in the head. I actually think he was shot, stabbed, then slashed. I'll explain why when I get a little farther into Jody's explanation of the events. Next, though, something very, very, very interesting happens with this camera during the whole 130 seconds that Travis is being murdered. About 45 seconds after the last photo is taken, where Travis is sitting in the shower, a short series of three more photos are taken, unbeknownst to Jody, I'm thinking. And the first of these photos shows an angled view of the ceiling area as if the camera was falling. The second shot is a whole minute and a half after the first one, and it shows Travis's bloody body near a female foot. The third accidental photo captures Travis's body from a different position, likely from when he was being moved back into the bathroom, as the third photo was actually an entire minute and 30 seconds after the second photo. It clearly shows that he was likely dead and that the first photo was probably taken when Jody actually started attacking Travis. After Jody killed Travis in his home bedroom hallway, she was able to move his body back into the bathroom area and even into the shower. She likely rinsed his body off of what I imagine would have to be some obscene amount of blood given the wounds that he incurred. And after doing all this incredible amount of work to distance herself from the murder by stealing her grandpa's gun, renting a car, borrowing gas cans so she wouldn't have to stop, dyeing her hair, removing the rental car's license plates, shutting her phone off, all of this shit. This stupid bitch just deletes these camera photos and fucking tosses Travis's expensive ass camera into his washing machine with the sheets from his bed, threw in some bleach, and started that bitch up, putting all her faith into this fucking washing machine, thinking that all the evidence would be destroyed in the process. She then grabs the knife, the gun, all her shit, puts the dog away, locks the doors, and dips the fuck out. How fucking dumb is that? She goes through that entire effort, all the effort, of hoarding the gas can so that she can't be traced to Mesa, but leaves 40 fucking photos on a camera at the scene of the crime. I don't understand why she just didn't take the camera with her. I mean, even if the photos weren't available, though, there's still a shit ton of physical evidence still proving her involvement, too. But goddamn, I just can't believe the sheer stupidity. She was meant to get caught, or she wanted to get caught. There is no other reason. And don't forget that Jody had actually told Ryan up in Utah that she was going to be arriving at his place that morning, just about the same time that she was bumping uglies with Travis. Ryan was literally waiting for Jody to show up all day so that they could do this PPL shit together. So while he's expecting her to arrive, she's pretty much getting down and dirty, literally, with Travis. This Ryan guy also testified at the trial, and he actually tried to call her that morning, of the 4th, about 9 a.m., he said it went straight to voicemail. She would have probably been sleeping up in Travis's bed. Ryan then called two more times between 1 and 9 p.m., also going to voicemail. He'd even called another mutual friend of theirs named Leslie to see if anyone else knew where Jody was because he was sort of getting worried about her, honestly. After the PPL event, he and some friends went to a cheesecake factory, which is, I guess, routine, and still no word from Jody until about 10:30 that night, which would have been 5 hours after Travis's murder, and like 10 hours after she said she was already going to be in Utah. So she calls Ryan and says, "Oops, I stupidly drove the wrong way on the highway for like over 100 miles, and I had to buy a new cell phone charger because I lost mine, and lastly, I'm out like 7 hours still." She just sort of played it off to being a fucking ditz, which he did not question at all, I guess. Whatever. Jody then finds herself near the Hoover Dam, likely where she dumped both the 25 caliber gun and the knife, which I believe she said originally came from Travis's dishwasher that day, either by Travis or by Jody. We'll never really know for sure, and both the weapons actually have yet to be found. But she also makes a strategic call to Travis's phone at about 11:37 p.m. that same night, and she obviously has to leave a message because he's not going to answer. And in this fake-ass voicemail, she says the same bullshit story about how she's getting lost on the way, and she's literally continuing on with this whole entire charade that she didn't just leave him nearly decapitated in his own bathroom shower.
"I know Leslie called you, so I already talked to her, so you can call her back if you want, but it's not necessary. My phone died, so I wasn't getting back to anybody. And I drove 100 miles in the wrong direction, over 100 miles, thank you very much. So yeah, remember New Mexico? It was a lot like that, only you weren't here to prevent me from going into the three digits, so fun. Tell you all about that later. Also, when we were talking about your upcoming travels my way, I was looking at the May calendar, duh. So I'm all confused. But Heather and I are going to see Othello on July 1st, and we would love for you to accompany us. I don't know when Team Freedom's event is, though, but, you know, it's on the list, so we could do Shakespeare, Crater Lake, and the coast. So if you can make it. If not, we'll just do the coast and Crater Lake. But let me know, and I will talk to you soon. Bye."
End of message.
So Ryan actually admitted that when she finally arrived at his house about 10 or 11 on Thursday, June 5th, he was surprised to see that her hair had actually been recently dyed dark because when they met, she was a blonde. And he also notices that she has a couple fingers bandaged up. And Jody told Ryan that she had accidentally cut herself, her finger, while, you know, washing a glass at her bartending job at Margaritaville. Well, guess what? There ain't no fucking Margaritaville where she lived. And the state even went out and got a cop to testify to that just to show how fucking high this bitch sits on her throne of lies. But apart from her weird-ass story about getting lost and stranded and then showing up so fucking late, Ryan said that she really just didn't act at all upset or anything. Nothing was off. Nothing she said would have indicated to him that she just brutally murdered someone a couple hours before they would literally be dry-humping on his love sack. He's on his way to a meeting as she shows up, so she quickly switches into some business casual, and she follows him to the meeting. But on the way, she actually ends up getting pulled over for the absolute dumbest shit you've ever heard. Remember when Jody removed the license plate from the front of the rental car? Well, she fucking put it back onto her car upside down. Wow. I mean, thank God she didn't have a red car, though, right? Stupid bitch. The prosecutor, Juan, asked this cop from Utah on the witness stand how in the world did he ever remember this one woman after all this time with all the traffic stops that he's ever done. And this old cop goes, "In the 20 years that I've been on the force, I've never ever had a traffic stop for an upside down license plate." To him, she seemed surprised and said something about her friends probably playing a trick on her. And he instructed her to just get it flipped around and just go about her day. He didn't really give a shit. So somehow it gets fixed, but neither Jody or Ryan can't remember who the fuck put the license plate back onto her stupid ass car. So that's sort of weird, but it really doesn't matter. She blamed it on those skater kids at Starbucks she went to earlier in the trip, before entering Arizona, remember? Ryan believes everything Jody and her $300 tits say, so whatever. She just got done adjusting his boner while they were cuddling, so, you know, what's to question? Jody tells Ryan that she's got to work later that day or the next day or whatever, so she has to get back on the road because she has to work at her fake margarita job. So she leaves Ryan's place at about 1 or 2 a.m. early Friday morning. That would have been June 6th. She worked this dude for real. She was like, I'm going to take this super long road trip just to come see you and hang out for 6 hours. I'm going to stick my hands down your pants and then I'm going to take a nap on your love sack. And then I'm going to turn around and I'm going to drive all the way back home because I got to work in Margaritaville. Sorry for the cock tease, Ryan. Bye. Again, the receipts she meticulously kept for investigators to find show that she then filled up her rental car at the Tesoro gas station in Salt Lake City, Utah at about 3:57 a.m. and she then starts the drive back west towards Nevada. Jody drives for about 6 or 7 hours and then she stops at an In-N-Out Burger in Sparks, Nevada to grab a bite to eat. She again gasses up her rental car and crosses over into California. And I know from interrogation videos that Jody had stopped by her parents' home on the way back to return her rental car. And her parents said that they didn't have any idea that anything was weird, really, or that anything was going on until the actual news of Travis's death had been given to Jody. And this would be days later, actually. But it wasn't until that moment that her parents are even aware that she had this boyfriend or ex-boyfriend because she never tells them anything. But I guess when she leaves their house, she casually mentioned something about needing to be safe because she might get blamed for something. So she goes out and she purchases a 9mm handgun. And I'm thinking it's because she wanted a different size gun in her possession than the size they would find in Travis's head. But also, she alluded to the idea that she was somewhat suicidal after this whole trip. So maybe that's why. Who really fucking knows? Jody's logic is just honestly a whole ass shit show most of the time. So before returning the rental car, Jody fills up the gas tank one last time at a Valero in Redding, California, and then heads to return the white Ford Focus back to the budget near the Redding Municipal Airport. She had initially told the clerk that she was just going to be driving it locally, but when she showed up 4 hours late with almost 3,000 miles put on the car, the dude was sort of surprised to see that much driving had been done. She explained, you know, she just kind of decided to take a bit longer of a trip than she planned. He's like, whatever. He then checked the car out to make sure there wasn't any damage, as usual, and when he looks inside the car, he testified that there were these red Kool-Aid stains on both the front driver's seat and also the back seat. There was a big old red Kool-Aid stain. This same employee also said on the stand that by the looks of Jody, he just sort of assumed that there were juice stains from some kids that she might have had in the car or something. And they didn't think much of it, and they just decided to shampoo it right away. So here's Jody's white privilege and fake boobs working for her. The dude also noticed that all four of the car's floor mats were missing. And though he said he was fairly certain that the floor mats were in there when she left with the car, he can't prove it. So police also did not have a chance to access the car until after it had been cleaned by the budget employees, so nothing found in that car was or whatever be able to be used in court as evidence. And you know what, too? She never returned those two fucking gas cans to Daryl either. The fucking succubus. All right, you guys, this is where I'm going to cut it for part two. Later, we'll cover the discovery of Travis's body, Jody's crazy-ass stories to police detectives, and the most X-rated courtroom trial I think ever happened in modern history. And most importantly, what I think exactly happened in Travis's bedroom that fateful day. If you're interested in hearing the second half of this wild-ass story, definitely consider checking out the Patreon/GingerTheTrueCrimeQueen. I have 2 tiers going on right now. I got a $3 support tier where you can vote for future cases that I should cover, as well as the main $5 tier that drops the early episode releases, the bonus episodes like this, where I really plan to be covering these big cases pretty in depth. The more controversial cases, you know. And no worries, if Patreon isn't your thing, the second best way that you can help support my podcast is to just simply share it with a friend. Of course, I appreciate all the listeners. It's been super nice to see that all this hard work is paying off and it's also being enjoyed at the same time. So please send some of those good vibes our way up in the Pacific Northwest right now. The entire West Coast is literally on fire right now, if you didn't know. And with the year that we've had, it's just like one fucking thing after the other, am I right? Stay safe, everyone. I'll meet you back here in a couple weeks with another crazy ass story. This time it's going to be a Patreon request out of the beautiful but Hella on Fire, Oregon State. As always, remember to lock those damn doors. Even your doggy doors, because you don't want Jodi Arias crawling in your doggy doors and stabby McStab stabbing you. So watch out for them. All right, you guys. Bye. That was the tea, you guys. I hope you enjoyed my rendition of this story, and if so, please tell all your creepy-ass friends about it. You can find the sources I used for the episode in its description. You can find me slinging those memes on Instagram at TrueCrimeQueen. Check them out if you need a laugh after all this dark shit. If you like what I'm doing here and you want to support the podcast, check out the Patreon.